This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. We start on Mondays with Elise Glink, Think Glink Media. You can visit thinkglink.com. She's also the author of 100 Questions Every First-Time Home Buyer Should Ask. Hi, Elise. Welcome back.
Hey, John. Happy Thanksgiving week.
Yeah, you too. I know that Steve just mentioned the Jerome Powell news, but talk a little bit more about that. What's most important relative to him getting picked again?
Well, I think the thing that everybody likes is that it's continuity, right? We know what we're getting with Jerome Powell. We think we know what he thinks about inflation, when he thinks that will abate. We know what he thinks about the supply issues and the supply chain problems. And I think that when you're in a period of instability, which we've been in thanks to COVID, it's nice to have someone that you can count on. There were a lot of people who were hoping that Lael Brainard was going to be get the top seat, but instead she's been named the vice chair, and I think that's probably a good balance between the two.
I'm just reading from a piece here. What's the source of this? This is CNBC. So he oversaw unprecedented stimulus, but he wasn't the instigator of that. Congress approved and the president signed all of these checks that people were getting, right?
Yeah, they did. And it was whenever you're facing something like the Great Recession from 12 or 13 years ago, or COVID, the pandemic, which was a complete unknown when this all started, you want somebody who has been there, who's been going through it. And that's where Jerome Powell kind of comes into play. So I think that, Joe Biden picked what was I'm going to use the word more conservative choice, not politically, although Powell is a registered Republican, but it's conservative because it's known. It's a known quantity. And I think what President Biden and his administration are trying to do now is to quell the anxiety that people have, the ongoing anxiety over COVID and the pandemic and when this is going to be over. And they're watching Europe start to shut down again, and the numbers are going up in Michigan and Minnesota. So there's a lot of anxiety there. Keeping Powell in place takes one of those pieces of anxiety off the table.
But inflation is the new anxiety people have. So if we feel like we've got boosters and unemployment is now under 5, where it was over 14, it was almost 15. Now it's under 5. I mean, those are all good things. And then, you trade one devil for another.
You do. I wish my crystal ball was in crack, John. I could give you a much more concrete look at where we were going over the next few years. But, there's a lot to like here. Jerome Powell has been rather steady. He believes in more open communication. So we've been able to hear a little bit more about how the Fed is thinking about these things. He's trying to be more clear in his conversation, which for all of us who watch this sort of thing and parse through the verbiage, we're happy about, right? Because it gives us more to look at.
I want to talk about real estate in the next segment and also Thanksgiving travel, but just one other sort of business number here. The unemployment in Nebraska is 1.9%. It says in the Wall Street Journal, the lowest unemployment rate of any state ever, 1.9%.
Yeah, want a job? Go there.
Wonder what
they have a lot of them.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to see what it says about other states. It's obviously higher.
It is higher, but what's interesting about Nebraska is when you usually hear about ultra-low unemployment, you don't hear about it in Nebraska. You hear about it in the Dakotas, North Dakota and South Dakota. And a lot of that push has been the fracking industry or the oil and gas industry driving this kind of, ultra-low unemployment. But Nebraska, this is the first time in a long time that I've heard Nebraska pop up as having the lowest unemployment rate. The fact that they're at 1.9% is truly stunning. They have like 70,000 open jobs. Now, part of this is there's just not as many people there as, say, in New York State, but still a good number for them.
Yeah, I don't want to be cynical, but maybe the folks who could not get jobs or did not want to work in Nebraska left, and so those who remain are working the land or working for the university or working in an agricultural corporation or something like that.
Well, you have states like Idaho, right? Boise has just exploded in terms of its population. It's the number of people who are moving there is somewhat extraordinary. But you're seeing that growth in tech jobs and investing jobs, as well as seeing it in things that you might normally think of for Idaho, right? Farming or oil and gas, the energy industry. It's just interesting to watch how the home price growth has spurred, you know, has become mm-hmm. this thing, because different people are moving from different places. They can do their jobs remotely.
Actually, I'll just read a little further here. It says Nebraska's population grew 7.4% between 2010 and 2020, at the same rate as the overall U.S. over the same period, and experienced an acceleration from 2000 to 2010, when the estate's population increased 6.7%. The problem is they can't keep up with the labor. As much as their population has grown, the demand for jobs there and elsewhere is even greater. We're talking to Elise Glink on the Wintrust Business Lunch about travel, by the way, Elise. Gas prices, not surprisingly, are higher, both at the pump and also heating your home. What are you seeing and hearing about all of that?
Boy, is it expensive. I keep driving by my local Shell station, and it feels like every single time I pass it, it's up a couple of pennies. There is a story today in the New York Times about how people are not able to go visit their families this holiday season simply because it costs too much for gas and they can't afford it. What we're seeing is that 32% of Americans are planning to drive for Thanksgiving. That's down from 35% last year at the height of the pandemic, and down from 65% in 2019, just to give a little bit more of a perspective. And those are from GasBuddy.com. But still, you know, from AAA, 53 million Americans are going to hit the road, and they're going to be paying higher prices.
I'm surprised those numbers you just said. You said 32% of Americans plan to drive for Thanksgiving, down from 35% last year. I mean, I guess nobody went anywhere last year. And then at the height of the pandemic, and then 65% of us traveled. So we've gone from 65% to 32%. It's half.
It is, and there are a lot of people flying. So by the same token, right? So we're talking driving versus flying. So I think it was yesterday or over the weekend, we heard the TSA screen 2.2 million passengers, which is basically the most that they've done since the pandemic began. So people are traveling for Thanksgiving, and there's going to be kind of a crazy amount of travel. But in terms of driving versus flying, Gas Buddy at least says that it's going to be a little bit less, about half of what it was in 2019. AAA, you know, has slightly different numbers, but they're not so different, right? When you look at what the actual number that AAA said, they said 56 million people traveled in 2019, 49 million by automobile, 4.6 million by air. So the numbers are a little bit different. It'll be interesting to see who's right this year.
I'm trying to remember if it was Vicky Kikuzian or Bob Surratt, but early this morning they said the worst time to travel will be Wednesday between 1 and 5 p.m., which is about when I guess most of us, me included, are getting out of Dodge. So the roads will be about as crowded as they can be, probably on the outbound everything, Wednesday between 1 and 5.
The big issue, John, is what's going to happen with the weather. You know, there's been talk this week about how some parts of the country, particularly in the East Coast, are looking at rain/snow and a fairly serious storm that's coming through. And I've been watching it here in Chicago because, you know, on Wednesday, it's supposed to be in the 50s again here, and yeah, then it's going to drop back down to the 30s. And I just, if you're driving, be careful of what's going on with the weather wherever it is you're going so you don't get into some sort of an accident.
Talk to me about home loans, home prices, and stuff like that. What's news on that front?
Yeah, so $1 million just doesn't buy what it used to. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have decided that they will now back home loans up to nearly $1 million in high-cost areas. That does not sadly include Chicago. But what does include Chicago is the conventional loan limit, which is going to be $625,000. And I was laughing to myself about this because when I started writing about real estate, I think the conventional loan limit was somewhere around 2.25. And now we're at $625,000. And that means that if you're going out to buy a house and it costs, let's say $625,000 plus whatever you have for a down payment, you may be able to get conventional financing, which is the cheapest and easiest financing to get, for a house that costs somewhere around $800,000, which is just amazing.
So have you talked to people that live in San Francisco or have family members that live in San Francisco or some of those notoriously expensive places? It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. The median home price condo for, let's say, in San Francisco, for example, now is about $1.5 million. So even in the high cost areas, a conventional loan isn't going to cover everything that you would need. It's still going to be a higher cost thing. But that kind of pricing there, and we just were talking about Boise. Boise is not a high cost area, and yet the median price of homes is really skyrocketed. And so this $625,000 is meant to cover places like Boise, Idaho, which a dozen years ago was nowhere near this kind of price.
Yeah. And then you say, well, how do people afford it? And then you find out that it's two incomes, not infrequently, and they're really high incomes because they're in the Silicon Valley, or the pay reflects the real estate. And so people get inflated paychecks there, and then they give it right back to whoever has underwritten their home loan.
Well, it's also, this is really where you see super low interest rates come into play. So when you can get a home loan for less than 3%, and right now, 30-year rates went back under 3% over the last couple of weeks. And so we've seen mortgage interest rates come down despite the high inflation. Interest rates are very, very low historically. And when you can get a 15-year loan for about 2.5% and a 30-year loan for under 3%, that allows you to spend as much as five times your income, provided you have the down payment to go with that, and still fall within conventional guidelines. And so what we're seeing is that people are definitely stretching to get into these bigger homes, but you might be able to buy a house that's five times your income, and that's just the power of interest rates.
And that's Elise Glink, real estate and financial wellness expert. Visit thinkglink.com and also listen for The Week in Wealth. That airs Wednesdays. I'm sorry, it's on WGN Radio Sundays from 6:30 to 7 in the morning.
Okay. Yeah, and this week, John, we're going to talk about the tax implications of Biden's new infrastructure and the $2 trillion bill that went through. So lots to talk about there.
Elise and Tom Fortino. Nice to talk to you, Elise. We'll be listening.
You too, John. Happy Thanksgiving.
This is John Williams. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Mondays at this time, we say hi to Jim Dahlke. He's the senior editor at Chicago Inno. We'll talk in a minute about a dog feeder, which I've been watching the video of over and over again, Jim. And it's kind of funny and fascinating and smart that that's right here in Chicago. But let's start by talking about the husband and wife duo that are bringing a new kind of cuisine for some Chicagoans to town, right?
That's right, John. So this startup is called Ayo Foods, A-Y-O. And they are a company that is creating a line of West African cuisine that shoppers can find in their grocery store freezer aisles. Just launched last year, actually during the summer of 2020 and during the pandemic, and have really grown quickly. They're now in 4,000 stores across the country, places like Whole Foods, Target, Kroger, Safeway. Revenue is up about 850% this year. It's really resonating with shoppers. Its meals include items like jollof rice and chicken yassa, and they've even partnered with a former Top Shelf to create some different dishes that they're putting together. So really taking off here, and yet another example of a Chicago CPG startup that's really kind of hitting its stride.
CPG stands for?
Consumer packaged goods. And, they raised $1.5 million this year from a venture firm that's investing in a lot of CPG firms in the city, Cleveland Avenue, the former McDonald's CEO, Don Thompson. That's his firm that invests in businesses that are owned by Black, Latino, and women founders through a $70 million VC fund that they're launched here in Chicago. So a lot of momentum in the food startup space here in the city.
You wrote about a public speaking app with the Chicago connection. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this app is called Speako, S-P-E-E-K-O. They were founded a few years ago based here in Chicago, and they've created an app for public speaking. Essentially what it does is allows you to record yourself speaking and then uses artificial intelligence to give you feedback on your pace and word choice, other techniques, lets you know if you're using filler words or if you can sound more dynamic in certain ways. And also if your speaking could be more inclusive, ditching phrases like, hey guys. And actually to date, the startup says it's helped correct and count more than 1 million ums from speakers' language. And just last week, they were part of the Apple App Store app of the day. So they got a big boost from Apple last week that they said was a big driver of downloads for them.
I can imagine. Is that a free app, did you say?
Yeah, so it's one of those freemium models. So it starts as free and then has some upgraded features to let you to pay for it. And you know, really, they kind of started out as this sort of Duolingo for speech where, you know, you can kind of get feedback and take classes. But they kind of see a big opportunity for live feedback, kind of like a grammar checker for live speaking, especially as you're doing, you know, Zoom chats and Google Meet. So plugging directly into those video chats to kind of let speakers know if they can improve their public speaking in real time.
I always assume that people that have a lot of those verbal hiccups, and we all have them, but the ums and you knows and you guys and words like that, even people who begin every sentence with the word so, you see that every now and then. I always assume that they knew that and didn't care or weren't, you know, weren't working on it. But maybe this will highlight to them something they don't realize, huh?
Absolutely. And I think that one thing you see a lot, too, is, you know, the proliferate, there's so many podcasts out there in the world too. And I think that you hear some of these same, you know, ticks over and over again that I think it just kind of gets ingrained in your brain. And so just having a little bit of a grammar checker for your voice is not a bad idea.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. That's called Speako, S-P-E-E-K-O or C-O? Speako.
K-O.
K-O. Talk to, well, do the Winklevoss twins. And why are they in your site today?
Yeah, so a Chicago startup called Early Bird, really interesting fintech business in the city. They are helping families set up investment accounts for their children and making it really easy for, you know, your friends and family to, you know, give financial gifts to this investment account. And they just raised some fundraising or just today, raised $4 million. The co-founder of Reddit, his firm is behind it. So Alexis Ohanian's 776 firm, they invested as well as Gemini's Frontier Fund, which is the venture arm of the crypto firm owned by Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, a bunch of other big names in the round. But a pretty interesting growth here for a Chicago startup that's you know, kind of taking a different approach to the investment space here. And, you know, they say with this investment, not only will you be able to, you know, invest in stocks and ETFs, but also cryptocurrencies now. So folks will be able to, you know, back crypto and create those wealth investments for their kids.
Here's the headline of a story you wrote. Meet the stylish kibble dispenser for dogs that's blowing up on TikTok. So I watched the video, went online and Googled this and found it, and I laughed out loud. It is so simple, but what a good idea.
Simple is exactly the right way to describe it, right? It's just really no technology in this thing. It's just a stylish, slick-looking kibble dispenser, and it fills up the bowl with a crank of a handle. So you pull the handle once, pull it back, and the perfect amount of food comes out in the bowl. I think what's so interesting about this is the virality it's seen on TikTok. Its videos have been watched more than 120 million times. It's just a very simple 8-second clip of the device in action. Is its most watched video, viewed more than 86 million times. TikTok is this very crazy social media platform that is clearly capable of driving lots of traffic to very visual brands. And it's helped to get their Kickstarter campaign off the ground. So they're looking to raise $100,000 to ship these out to backers and have already raised over that amount with more than 3 weeks left in their campaign.
It's kind of a slick, they describe it as mid-century styled wooden box, kind of tall, has the lever and handle on the top, and then a little tray that the bowl goes in and then comes back out after filling up with the right amount of food. $299. $299.
Yeah, the price point is $299 if you get it on the Kickstarter. If you're going to wait till after the campaign, it's $399. And you know, really what they see is this is a high-end piece of furniture, according to the founders, right? This is something that you don't put in a closet or in your garage. This is next to your couch. This is it complements your coffee table. They view this really as a piece of high-end furniture more than just a kibble dispenser.
And the name of this device is called what again?
Houndsy.
Hounsy, H-O-U-N-D-S-Y. Yeah, you've heard about this video? It's 8 seconds long, so that's it. But that's all you need to know to appreciate the genius of this thing right here in Chicago. Nice to talk to you, Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno. ChicagoInno.com's the website. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, John.
WGN Radio's Business Lunch continues now with more business news and Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Ford and Rivian have canceled plans to jointly develop electric vehicles. Rivian has a manufacturing plant in downstate Normal. Ford expects to become the nation's second biggest EV producer within several years without Rivian's help. Ford is doubling its planned EV production capacity to 600,000 globally by the end of 2023. Startup Rivian Automotive is now worth about 50% more than Ford, which was one of its early investors. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got your business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yes, sir. Return with me now to yesteryear, 1975. When General Foods came out with
new stovetop stuffing instead of potatoes. Now it's got real chicken broth.
Wait till you taste it.
Oh, and a lot of people have tasted it. About 60 million boxes are sold each year. And with yesterday being National Stuffing Day, what better time to give long overdue credit to the inventor of stovetop stuffing? Her name was Ruth Seams. She grew up in Evansville and graduated from Purdue, and then went on to a career at General Foods, where she created that stovetop magic.
She was really the inventor of it, but on the patent, there are three other names after hers, and two of those names are supervisors of hers.
Sammy Morris is head of archives and special collections at Purdue, and in the archives are articles about Ruth Seams' time as a student and about how her contribution was largely forgotten.
One of them was an interesting story told by her brother that, you know, I think people kind of forgot that she was the inventor, or they just associated it with the company and not individual names. And there was a point when there was like a 50-year anniversary for stovetop stuffing, and there were T-shirts and things. She didn't even get one of the T-shirts. But according to her brother, she had a good sense of humor about it. And the back of the T-shirt said, "Stuff it." And she said, "Yeah, that sums up my remarks on that."
Ruth worked at General Foods for 35 years, and she would have worked there longer, but
there was a quote in one of the obituaries of hers that I read that said that when Philip Morris took over General Foods, they got rid of all the employees who were over 50 years of age. And that's actually how she was let go from General Foods, because she was past 50.
So a belated tip of the casserole dish lid to stovetop stuffing inventor Ruth Seams, Purdue class of 53, passed away in 2005 in Newburgh, Indiana. A tight global supply of wheat is driving futures higher at the Chicago Board of Trade. Wheat right now is up 23 cents, about 2.75% at 8.57 a bushel. Soybeans are up a dime at 12.73, and corn is up 6 cents at 5.83. And that is your money on 720. Oh, this today from the farm to your belly is National Cranberry Relish Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Amy Guth joins us. I'm looking at the Target story, Amy. Why don't you start there today?
Yeah, certainly. I totally agree. This is really just kind of a more evidence of how consumer behavior has changed during the pandemic. So Target has announced that it will no longer open stores on Thanksgiving Day permanently. That's a thing they're doing. They had suspended that last year. Obviously, there was a lot of restriction around shopping and a lot of different issues we were all grappling with. But they said, you know, we realize we can take care of customers without being open on Thanksgiving Day. So we're not going to do that anymore. They're going to lean a little bit more into their digital presence for that day, be open the following day and still, you know, be there for Black Friday. They also, it was partly a business decision. It wasn't all in just about giving workers time to be with their families. Mm-hmm. They said it by being open on Thanksgiving Day, it kind of cannibalized some of that big number that everyone kind of looks at for revenue for what happened on Black Friday and who kind of won that pack. So they're kind of trying to consolidate all that into Black Friday by being closed on Thanksgiving from here on out.
It's funny how that whole argument has even changed.
Yeah.
The whole dynamic is different, because it used to be very much about the care of the employees and maybe some of the customers, but let's just tell everybody to go home on Thanksgiving. That would have been the nice thing to do, except you couldn't afford to do it because Walmart and Sam's Club and Kohl's were going to be open on Thanksgiving, so you had to be open on Thanksgiving. Pandemic comes along, Now, you don't have, and maybe this is going to happen anyway, right? Because of the internet. Eventually it was going to happen just because brick and mortar maybe isn't so important that day.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's been some big names like Costco and Nordstrom. They always said they wanted to respect the holiday and not be open. But you really hit the nail on the head. That's exactly it. You know, big box stores would get such a big boost by being open. It was really hard for a business to say no, especially something like Target, where you can do a lot of different types of shopping in one place. So to me, that's a pretty big move from Target. And we'll see if other stores follow suit.
Talk about the Bezos donation to the Obama Foundation.
Yeah, A.D. Quigg from Crain's reported this earlier today. So Jeff Bezos has given $100 million to the Obama Foundation. What will happen with that money? It is unrestricted, but he's made this donation in honor of late civil rights activist Congressman John Lewis. And so as part of that, the Obama Presidential Center's plaza will be named after Lewis. And in a statement from the Obama Foundation, they said there's opportunities to honor people that have been leaders in the social justice space and change makers in public service and business and in entertainment by dedicating public spaces at the center to honor different people. So there are still, they kind of laid out some other opportunities, and we'll see if other donors step up and want to name and give an honor of others.
Wonder if there's going to be a Jesse Jackson Plaza then. He's the civil rights leader most associated, arguably, with Chicago. I don't see that in here. Huh?
Yeah. 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 We'll see. We'll see if other donors, want to get behind and honor other people for sure.
Uber Eats. What's the news there?
Yeah. So in Ontario, which is not here, but just north of us and northeast of us, Ontario, Canada is going to allow Uber Eats to make deliveries for cannabis. So they're going to list a cannabis retailer called Tokyo Smoke on its marketplace starting today. That means you can order your cannabis from Uber Eats and then, go through and pick it up from the Tokyo Smoke store or all of that. But kind of moving into that delivery space, I think, is really interesting to both allow Uber Eats to fulfill that order for you and to do delivery. I kind of looked into this a little bit. There is a company called Ease that TechCrunch wrote about back in August. That is a cannabis delivery company. They purchased a company called Green Dragon that was in that retail and cultivation space. They mostly operate in Colorado and Florida, but they're looking to kind of have a handle on that by the time we see federal legalization of recreational marijuana. So I think that's just kind of an interesting idea, both being able to fulfill that order. There are some apps like that allow you to make an order for a cannabis dispensary here even now. But to get into that kind of imagining down the road of delivery is a whole other game and what's really shaping up to be such a humongous industry.
It's funny because you got federal rules that govern banking. You think there'd be federal regulations about transportation of a substance over state lines or something like that.
For sure. And so that's kind of part of it. Even, I've interviewed folks before that are in the cultivation and dispensary space, and even just setting up an operation, there's a really fascinating kind of process they have to go through just to get their supplies, like the seeds, in order to start growing, just to get them into the state. And even especially leading up to legalization in Illinois, getting all of the cultivation supplies in here before it was technically legal. It was a whole process that's really interesting. And if you have to order that from another state, there's the consideration of what states does it need to cross in order to get here, things like that, a whole lot of considerations. So I think, a lot of people, a lot of lawmakers have been pushing for federal, at least decriminalization, if not legalization. And banking is such a huge part of that, for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. Time's up today. Let's talk again later this week. Thank you, Amy.